I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles at the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. What if you could harness the power of the free market to solve the problems of poverty, hunger, and inequality? That's exactly what Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Prize winner who invented microcredit, is doing. Yunus's Next Big Idea offers a pioneering model for nothing less than a new, more humane form of capitalism. In this podcast, you'll hear Yunus discuss creating a world without poverty in conversation with Rick Wortsman, director of the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. This program was originally produced on January 15, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Great. First, thanks. Thank you, Louise, for such a gracious introduction. And I want to start actually by telling one very quick story. I had the pleasure of meeting you for the first time this morning. I was able to come to LAX and with Professor Yunus's driver, pick him up. He was in from Houston. He's on this Whirlwind book tour, and so I wanted to spend a little time with him, I wanted to drive with him wherever I could, so we were going to go from LAX, and he needed to get to a radio interview early this morning, and so we got in the car, and everything was going fantastic until we ended up in completely the wrong location, and through no fault of the driver, I may add, and there was a big mix-up, and suddenly we thought, man, this live radio gig he's got, this is going to be trouble. And we needed to get all the way up the 405 and then down the 101. And boy, I'm thinking, there's no way. And amazingly, I've never seen LA's freeways like this. Virtually no traffic. What few cars there were, they just seemed to part magically. So if I had any doubt that you are doing God's work, that's a Los Angeles miracle right there. So thank you for that. I want to talk quite a bit tonight about your new book and creating a world without poverty and this idea of what you've termed social business and really as a way that it might help put poverty where you say it belongs, namely in a museum. But this concept really grew out of your whole development of microlending and microcredit and Grameen's work there. And so I want to start there as the foundation, and then we'll sort of work our way forward. I think there's some logic to that. So this is probably a bad way to tell a joke, which is to give the punchline first. But I do want you to begin by talking a little bit. Louise talked very quickly about what microcredit is. But my guess is there's a mix of folks here, some of whom are very conversant in what microcredit's all about. Why don't you tell us a little bit about just what microcredit is, what size loans Grameen Bank typically makes, and what those loans are for? Why don't we start there?
Well, microcredit, I would say, loans to people who never get a loan from a conventional bank to begin with. That would be one way to look at it. Another way is a loan for the poorest people without collateral, without any guarantee, without any legal papers or anything, for income-generating activity, and which is paid in small installments, weekly, biweekly, or something like that. So that will be the microcredit. Usually, it will be starting from anywhere. It could be as small as $1. As my story goes, it started with $27 given to 42 people. So you can
42 people,
$27. So it could be as small as that. Even today, we have loans after 31 years of our work. We have loans which starts at about $10, $15. So it could be as small as that. It could be bigger as we go along. But the average right now within Grameen Bank, I would say about $150.
$150 loans.
We lend out over $500 million a year to 7.5 million borrowers. Average loan would be $150.
And what are these loans typically used for? You talked about income-generating activity. Yeah. What does that mean?
Meaning that anything will make you earn some money. our borrowers, 7.5 million borrowers that I talk about, 97% of them are women. So we are very women-focused program. The poorest women get in, almost destitute women who would be joining in Grameen Bank. And she only thing she think about, which she is familiar with, raising few chicken, selling eggs. So that would be her enterprise. Or processing paddy. Buy the paddy from the market and pound them and make clean rice and sell it. She knows how to do it, and immediately she gets an income. So this is another familiar thing. If she is bold enough, she will buy a cow, sell milk, and pay back the loan and become owners of assets. Yeah.
So again, to skip to the punchline, can you talk a little bit about the dramatic difference that these loans have made just in the aggregate? You have, as I understand it, lifted lots of people out of poverty. What do the numbers look like in terms of that metric of success?
Well, I have not lifted anybody out of poverty.
The Grameen, I should
people,
say.
People lifted themselves out of poverty. We try to keep track of what is the situation so far as her income is concerned, and whether how many of the borrowers of Grameen Bank getting out of poverty. This is a routine annual thing that we exercise that we go through. 2006 figure is the borrowers of Grameen Bank who have been with Grameen Bank for 5 years or more, 64% of them have crossed over the poverty line. So each year, each day, each month, more and more coming out. There are World Bank studies which are done, multi-year, multi-million dollar research, focused on Grameen Bank's performances and impact on the people. They tell that on an average, 5% of Grameen borrowers get out of poverty every year. So that's another way of looking at it. Besides, we also see whether the children are going to school. So one of the things that we try to encourage right from the beginning to send the children to school, because these are all illiterate people. The women who joined Grameen Bank are illiterate, their parents are illiterate, their husbands are illiterate. But we wanted to make sure that this generation that will come out after they join Grameen Bank are literate, go to school, and that has happened. So it's nearly 100% of the children of Grameen families are in school. And many of them in higher education now. We have encouraged them with the scholarships and so on. And we give them student loans. Right now, there are more than 21,000 students in medical schools, engineering schools, universities. Several of them have PhDs. So it's this amazing generation coming up from totally illiterate families, families where literacy never entered ever in history. Now have a completely different generation, a new generation coming up. So this is one aspect of also, not only the income level goes up, also you create a new generation where cycle of poverty would not continue to continue as it is, as it has been continuing over years.
And the catalytic effect of these loans, what it allows people to do, how it helps generations, I think if you can just one more sort of bigger picture thing to talk about, which is what it's done in terms of the overall poverty rate of Bangladesh. It's come down dramatically, hasn't it, in the last 30 years or so? And I assume that microcredit from Grameen largely, but other institutions as well, has really propelled this.
Bangladesh was known when it was born, as some described it as a basket case, that this country will never make it, it'll never get out of the rut they're in. It was identified as the poorest country in the world and so on and so forth. But the poverty has been declining very steadily in Bangladesh. It declined on an average of 1% per year during the 90s, the whole decade of 90s. So nearly 10% of the poverty declined during the 90s. In the first 5 years of 2000, the poverty has declined at an average rate of 2% per year. So at that rate, if we continue, Bangladesh is right on the track to achieve Millennium Development Goal to reduce poverty by half by 2015. But our expectation is the rate of decline in poverty will be faster than 2% as we go along. So if it becomes faster, as we are hoping, then we will be reaching Millennium Development Goal of poverty reduction by before 2015. So that's a very exciting thing for us.
And Grameen has done this, the banking part, while running a pretty successful business on business terms, yes?
This, again, Grameen Bank is owned by the borrowers.
Right.
Meaning that these women who are taking loans from Grameen Bank, they are the owners of Grameen Bank. With this 31 years of our work, only initial 3 years, the bank lost money. Ever since, after that, it's always earned profit. So we had no problem of making profit. And profit goes back to the borrowers.
Yeah. Right. And you've stopped taking any outside
donations
as well, right?
That's right. We began with our own money. We never taken money from outside. First, I started with little money from my pocket. And then I became a guarantor to the banks. I was signing papers, taking risk, and taking money from the banks. Mm-hmm. Giving it to the people and offered myself to help it to facilitate to get money back to the bank. So that period continued until 1982. We began in 1976. For the first 6 years, there was no external money or anything. Only in 82, one UN agency, IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, they insisted that we should take some money. We said, we don't need money. We have plenty of money. but they said, we want to participate. It's such a great idea, what you are doing. So at their insistence, we took some money. So that was the beginning of us taking money from outside. And since then, we have taken external money from NORAD, Swedish CEDA, Canadian CEDA, and so on and so forth, KfW, GTZ. Then in 1995, we decided not to take any money from anybody. And since then, we never took any money from anybody because there's plenty of money within the bank because bank takes deposits
right. And
it lends the money to the people. Each branch actually is independent financially. It doesn't borrow from head office. It doesn't borrow from another branch. It just mobilizes its deposits and lends money to the poor people in the same locality. It's the local money going to the local poor people and building the local economy.
Which means that people aren't defaulting. They're paying on time, regularly. You have a great, fantastic record.
Yes, our repayment record has always been good. Not only Grameen Bank repayment record is good. It's wherever the microcredit idea went, all over the world, repayment is one absolutely nobody complained about. They have a very high repayment record. This is amazing because there is no collateral, there is no guarantee, there is no legal papers and so on. Still people pay back.
And I want to come back to that point because I think it's really crucial and I think defies a lot of assumptions that at least people made initially about the way that the poor would behave.
Poor will behave. Anybody will behave.
Yes.
That's the assumption.
Although I think there were stereotypes
about. You have to really tie them down.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Yeah. Look at what happened to subprime.
Right. Well, yes, exactly. Exactly. They could use Grameen's rate for sure. This is a good place, I think, to go back to the beginning a little bit. It's 1974. Your home country has fallen into the grip of a terrible famine brought on by some natural disasters and the War for Independence. And you were teaching at the time, right, teaching economics seeing a very different economic reality right outside the university's gates from what you were telling your students in the classroom. Can you talk a little bit about that disconnect? Because that's really where it all began for you, right?
Yeah. You see, the reality of life is so different than the classroom situation where you have those elegant theories, all economic problems have beautiful solutions. But you walk out, people are dying of hunger. And there are many, many ways of dying. But the dying of hunger is very unusual because death comes at a very slow pace. Each day you are inching towards death and there's nothing can be done. And there's not, people are eating, people are enjoying, but some people are dying. And this is an amazing situation. So at that situation, you feel kind of empty, important. You are a useless person. You can't be of any help to anybody. So I was trying to get out of that feeling that I had. So I thought maybe I don't know what to do with the, this whole big problem, but I can at least try on one person. If I can be of some help to one person, that is something that I feel comfortable that I have done something at least to make it easy for one person, even for a day. So that's what I was doing in the village next door every day, going around talking to people and trying to do something. And then I see the problem of loan sharks, money lending, and then I try to make a list of the people who are borrowing from the loan sharks.
Tell me, you first met this woman, Sufaya Begum, mm-hmm. and yeah. Tell me her story.
She was making bamboo stool, and yeah. As I was walking by in the village, I saw this beautiful bamboo stool and a woman making that. And the contrast between the bamboo stool, shining, beautiful bamboo stool, and the kind of tattered clothes and the shabby shacks behind her didn't match. So I was wondering what happened to her. So I tried to talk to her. It's not easy to talk to a woman for a stranger. I come from outside. So anyway, I tried to make it easy for her to talk. In the conversation, I found out that she makes only 2 penny a day. And I couldn't believe why anybody should make only 2 penny a day making such beautiful bamboo stools. Finally, I found it. I tried to make some notes about how much money she spends on making it. I thought she didn't understand 2 penny, how the 2 penny thing comes. So after I recorded it, and I said, that's the result. That's what she gets. Because she didn't have the money to buy the bamboo. So she had to go to a trader to borrow money from him. And the money she needed to buy a bamboo is 25 cents. She didn't have the 25 cents to buy the bamboo. So the trader gave her the money. But the condition was, whatever she makes, she has to sell it to him. And he decides at what price he will buy it. So I said, well, this is a situation of converting one into a slave labor. Yeah. This is really, she is really a slave labor. All these transactions sounds like business. Actually, it is something else. So that's what kind of pushed me into looking into the situation of money lending in the village.
This was, I think you made a 22-cent yeah. loan to her, right?
That's
it was
right,
a, was
yeah.
a, was an initial
yeah.
loan.
Right.
And then surveyed the rest of the village to yeah. see who was using money lenders, and this is where
yeah.
you,
this is where
you
the
found the 40-some people, and it took $27
yeah.
in loans
yeah.
to break this cycle.
That's right, yeah.
Amazing. It's hard for us, I think for me, and I probably, I think, speak for a lot of people sitting out there, to really anybody in this country and to wrap our minds around the depth of poverty that you're talking about in a place like Bangladesh and in much of the developing world. I mean, I read about half the world living on the equivalent of $2 a day or less, and nearly a billion people living on the equivalent of $1 a day or less. And it's I can't fathom what that means. Can you talk a little bit about what life is really like in a village like Jobra or one of the villages there? What it's like in the absence of microcredit, and then what difference microcredit then makes if people can start to lift themselves in terms of the amount of food they can get, what kinds of things they eat, what the rhythm of their life is like.
Well, one way to look at it is. Bangladesh has right now 150 million people. When we were doing this, we were about 75 million people.
And this is in an area the size of Wisconsin, basically, right?
Yeah, it's the size of Wisconsin, right. But with 150 million people.
Right.
Yeah. At that time... The land that Bangladesh has, it's people, not many people could own land because land is such a short supply. So, half the population were landless people. So if you don't have land, you don't have a livelihood, really, because the land provided you the food, you cultivated the land, you grow food, and you take care of yourself. Those who do not have land, they have to find other sources of income. So the employment didn't have that much opportunity for all this half the population of the country. So their only survival is whatever odd jobs they could do and that's what they will bring food. So that's the only way they could survive, doing odd jobs or the agricultural jobs, which is very seasonal. At times of harvesting, you have some jobs. Otherwise, at the time of sowing, you have some jobs. Rest of it, you don't have jobs. So life was extremely difficult. So what we're trying to do is to see that if, instead of just sit around, if you can get a little money to start something to do with yourself, that's where the self-employment idea was there. And we supported it with the credit so that we lend money, you create your own income-generating activity and create a job for yourself and move on from there as well. If you're successful in that, you can expand it. You can go on hiring other people if you want and build up a business out of it. So this is how we wanted to shape it up.
And in terms of, you know, someone like Sophia, what does it mean in terms of her daily life? How does diet change?
Diet is, see, if people, many people on crisis time, months will be surviving one meal a day. If you are lucky, two meals a day, that sort of thing. And very minimum kind of clothing that you can afford. In winter, you don't have warm clothing. Your house is made of jute sticks, which is really don't make a good protection for anything. It's brittle little things. It's just make a house. So that's a kind of poverty widespread everywhere, and diseases and unhygienic conditions all around.
And those are the things that are now changing, that you've seen changing.
That's right, yeah.
You write both in Banker to the Poor and in your new book very passionately and I thought very persuasively about the wrong-headed assumptions that lots of development officials make from places like the World Bank, those running traditional anti-poverty programs that government officials make, that most economists make. We were joking today, Peter Drucker, whose work I'm so intimately involved with now, had a great line. He said that in all recorded history, there's not been one economist who's had to worry about where the next meal would come from. And I think that's something you can very much relate to. Tell us what you think some of these, what you call economic blind spots, a term I love, in your book, and why they've been so counterproductive in attacking global poverty. We touched on one, you know, the poor or bad credit risk. Well, that's certainly not proven to be true. What else is, you know, have you run up against these sort of assumptions that you think are backward or just wrong?
Well, the traditional way of poverty is looked at, you create jobs. If you create jobs, then poverty will be taken care of. So it's a question of how to create jobs. The only way they could think of creating jobs is building infrastructure, investing in highways and things of that sort. So World Bank and others specialized in mostly infrastructural jobs.
Big projects,
mega projects, with the hoping that these projects will build the economy, and when the economy keeps moving, the lot of jobs will be created, and then poor will be out of poverty. So they single-mindedly pursued that kind of policy. Even today, they pursue the same policy, creating environment for the infrastructural environment so that the businesses can move on. But there, they don't look at the people. They're just looking at the infrastructures. This is something which became known as a trickle-down theory, that you build the economy and the economy starts moving and gradually it will sip down and reach out to the poorest people. But in reality, the economy moves in a different direction. It's the top people who become rich, and economy keeps growing, and they become richer and richer. It doesn't flow into the poor people. This is the kind of thing happening in China right now. China is moving very fast. Its growth rate has been 10%, 11%, 12%.
But it's moving like that,
moving
right?
Like that. Top is moving up, and the bottom is still way down below. So the income gap becomes very, very high. So that's the kind of policies that have been pursued by financial institutions, international development institutions.
I know another area that's been pursued a lot, and I think is a traditional way to fight poverty in this country, is with job training and skills training. And I know you're not a big believer in that as an emphasis either. Tell me why that is.
No, many of the poverty programs look at training as a part of an important component of their work, because they assume that people they're poor because they don't know what to do. So you have to tell them, you have to train them to do things. So you go come up with great ideas about training this, training into this one, training into that one. In most of the cases, people go to this training program not because they need the skill that you are offering to the training program, because most training program also comes with some kind of financial benefit to the trainees who participate in it, some kind of daily allowance or something. So people come to just pick up that daily allowance. No, doesn't matter what you're teaching them. And they have no use for whatever you're taught, so you go home and still become the same way, because it's not followed up by something to be supported, either a credit facility or a marketing facility or whatever other facilities which are needed. So just assume that you train them and somehow they will change their life. It didn't work out. And our work started out by saying that people have enormous amount of idle capacity. They already know what to do, but they don't have an opportunity to translate into work because that financing is not possible.
Shut out of the financial system.
That's right. That's just an example of this lady who's making bamboo stool. She knows what to do, but she didn't have the money to do it, and somebody else took the advantage of her situation and made money himself rather than letting her make the money. Many of the things that you see around done are done by poor people, like just one example, probably familiar example, a repairman, someone who repairs cars, repairs equipments or whatever. He knows his job very well. He does it all the time. But the repair shop is not owned by him. He works for the repair shop. And the shop attracts customers because he's there. Right. The guy who owns the repair shop, he doesn't know a thing about the equipment. He doesn't know what to do. All he does, he has the money, so he runs it, and profit comes to him. So if this repairman, the mechanic, if he had the money, if he had some sources of financing, if he had gone for himself, he would have made money himself. But just because he doesn't have the money, he cannot do that. Many of the taxi cab drivers don't owe the taxi, so it's the owner of the taxi who makes the money. In Bangladesh, if you go to Dhaka city, you'll see hundreds of thousands of rickshaws on the street. It's a very simple gadget, three-wheeler rickshaw. It costs very little, but the rickshaw pullers is not the rickshaw owners. Some guy somewhere owns the rickshaw. Yes. He's just a daily laborer kind of thing. He makes a little money out of it, and entire income goes to somebody else. Or he rents this rickshaw, where he has to pay a lot until he has earned enough to pay the rent. He cannot touch that money. So only over and above what he has to pay the rent, whatever extra he makes, that's his income. But if somebody had financed him to buy the rickshaw, entire income will come to him. Instead of giving it to somebody else as the rent, he could have paid the bank to pay back the loan, and the rickshaw would be his. So this is how all the ability is there, but the question of he cannot make use of that for his own benefit.
Why credit should be a human right, as you
That's
put it.
Right, yeah.
You're a big believer, and this was touched on a couple of times, that women, more than men, make the best borrowers, at least for Grameen and your strategy. Can you talk about why that is?
We had a little controversy with the conventional banks when I was trying to persuade them to lend money to the poor people. They will refuse to do that. So I was accusing them for two things. One, they are unjust because they refuse to lend money to the poor people. Another complaint that I was making about the conventional banks, not only they reject the poor people, they also reject women. And as evidence, I was showing them their figures that of all the borrowers that they have lent money to, not even 1% of the borrowers happen to be women. So I said, there's something wrong in your system. So when I began, I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my work are women, because I've been complaining about that issue a lot. So this I have to do. When I went to the woman to persuade her to take money, she said, no, don't give it to me. Give it to my husband, because I don't know anything about money. Literally, she never used money for anything, so she doesn't have any confidence to do that. So it took us a lot of effort to build confidence in the women to take the money. And finally, after 6 years of our continuous work for seeking women to come and join Grameen Bank, we made it to happen 50-50. Then we noticed that money that goes to the family through women brings much more benefit to the family than the same amount of money going to the family through men.
I find that shocking. Now, why is that?
Women have a lot of features, which is, at that time, I thought something Bangladeshi kind of features, but it's basically universal. Women paid a lot more attention to the children in the family than men do. So this is one very clearly demonstrated in our work. For example, poor families, as a coping mechanism, what they do, since they cannot feed all the children in the family, they give away these children to other better off families so that they can work there, they can be fed by those families in exchange of their work. So they become a kind of a slave labor themselves. They work day and night just for food. When a mother takes a loan, starts earning money, you see in that house, these kids are coming back. They're brought back to home. But you don't see that happening when a father is a borrower. Still the same way. So you can see the difference between the attitude of the mother to the children and father to the children. And also, if you look at the way a woman behaves, when she makes extra money, an income from the work she is doing. If you look at who should she direct her attention to with this money that she got, if you make a list, even an imaginary list, it will start with always children. Children becomes the first beneficiary of whatever she earns, and then household and others and so on and so forth. If you see whether she's in the list herself, probably she'll be the last item on the list rather than the first item on the list. But if you look at the men's list, it starts with him. And that goes down the other way.
Gotcha.
So this is another one. I mean, it's kind of a quality of self-sacrifice is built into a woman. Unlike men doesn't behave the way a woman behaves. Even the way money is kind of used after you receive. Traditionally, you see when a man receives a wage check or monthly check or a wage check, weekly check, the first thing he does, he goes to the pub. He enjoys himself. But in the same situation, probably woman got the same salary, same money, but she doesn't go to the pub. That makes a lot of difference between the two, what happens. And also women had a longer vision of some kind to get out of poverty. Men were more casual about it. Men didn't think about tomorrow. They're more enjoying today. A woman wanted to get out of the situation she is in because the poverty weighs much more heavy on a woman in the same family than it weighs on a man. So women wanted to get out of that situation as fast as she could, and she wants to build up something. She's looking forward to reach someplace, which you don't see very clearly when a man is working that way. So seeing all these things coming up, we changed our policy. We started focusing on women. We asked ourselves, what is so good about 50-50? And then we focused on women. As a result, we have 97% women.
I want to move on from microcredit, but I have a couple last questions. One is, does microcredit have a role here in the U.S.? We talked a little bit backstage about a place like New Orleans still suffering from the ravages of Katrina and what kind of role it could play there. And If so, why hasn't it caught on more here? I think there's maybe some institutional barriers.
Katrina is a disaster situation. So, of course, you need all the help you can get, and microcredit will be very helpful in building houses, building livelihoods all over again. But in general, if you look at the U.S. situation, millions of people in this country don't have bank account because bank will not accept your account because you're too small. They don't want to handle small accounts. So you are out. You can't do that.
Sucked into the payday loan racket.
Yeah,
or something.
And if you receive your check from your employer, and if you want to cash it, you can't put it in your account and get the money because you don't have a bank account. So you go someplace else. And that's why you have the check cashing companies all over the country. And they rip you off because you can't. Even a government check, which is as good as money, you can't get it. $1,000 check, you don't get $1,000. You get much less. Because somebody else makes money. So you need something. This is a microcredit situation where, meaning that the banks don't give you the service. You have to find another way of building that banking. So this is one. And the payday loans you just mentioned. You need a small amount of money between your two paychecks. Nobody will give it to you. So you go to the payday people, and they will charge you an enormous amount of interest, 40%, 50% interest on that one. So that's another one. And you see pawn shops everywhere, huge, big signs. You go to any city, any place, pawn shops. So this indicates the system doesn't work at the bottom very clearly, very loudly, boldly. Mm-hmm. And nobody notices it because those who matter, they have their bank accounts, so they don't have to pay attention to it. So that's what, in a country, the most richest country in the world and the most sophisticated banking system, for whom? The millions of people don't get to it.
So why? But there's some problems with microcredit, right, in terms of really having it take off here. You were explaining, I think, to me some institutional barriers about deposits. Can you explain that just quickly?
No, what I was saying that the microcredit programs which are operating in the United States have problems because they cannot take deposits because these are NGOs. NGOs are not supposed to take deposits. This is the same law everywhere. It's not just USA. So you need to have a banking license. You need to have a new banking law to allow to create microcredit banks. People say, why don't you take the usual banking law and create a bank and lend money to the poor people? My point is, yes, it can do that, but to create a bank in the United States, you need a huge lot of capital requirement, which is, again, built into the law itself. So the conventional banks is like a super tanker. It can go into the deep sea, carry lots of cargo. That's a kind of huge thing. But a microcredit bank is like a dinghy boat.
We need it some goes, dinghies, though.
Right. It goes into shallow waters. Right. So if with the architecture of a super tanker, if you build a dinghy boat, it won't work. It won't float. It will go down.
You need new architecture.
You need a new architecture. You need a new piece of legislation so that this can be done. This is what is needed. And then other problem besides legal problem. Other problem is the welfare law. Welfare law stands right in the middle of it. You cannot lend money to a welfare recipient. These are the people that you want to reach so that they can get out of welfare. But the law says, no way, you can't do that. You can't touch
them. They can lift themselves out. Yeah.
Yes, and law requires that if welfare recipient earns a dollar, he has to report it to the welfare authority so that dollar will be deducted from the check. It's a funny law because you are supposed to encourage people to earn money when you are in welfare so that you can get out of welfare. But the law is made in such a way they want to keep you there. They have no interest in getting you out.
Good segue, I think, into, again, this broader concept of social businesses. Just to touch quickly on, Grameen has expanded now. It is much more than a bank. It is a network of 26 companies, is that right? And you've gotten into all kinds of things, healthcare and education and fish farms and Handloom Fabrics. Those are, by the way, it's Grameen Czech, right?
Right.
Finest right there. It looks very, I like that very much. Yeah. There's one venture, though, that I think is really particularly interesting because it underscores the importance of information technology and its power in also helping the poor help themselves, lift themselves out of poverty, and that is Grameen Telecom. And I just wonder if quickly you could just touch on what that program, what that company is about and what it's been able to achieve.
I was a very enthusiastic supporter of bringing information technology to the poor people. I was arguing that microcredit is very important for poor people to change their life because it creates income, it creates their saving habits and so on. At the same time, the new technology that is flooding the world and changing the whole world would be very effective for changing poor people's lives, if you can bring that technology in the right manner to the poor people. While I was arguing that, I had no way I could demonstrate it, I could really test it out. One opportunity came when the government of Bangladesh was issuing licenses for private companies to go into providing cell phone service. So we applied. We thought, why not? Well, let's apply for a cell phone license and we'll create a new company. So we applied and we called our company Grameen Phone. And our idea was to bring cell phone in the rural areas, because at that time when we were applying, only telephones you have is in the city for the whole country of probably 130 million at that time, now 150 million. Only 500,000 telephones for the whole country, and mostly in the few cities. So we said, we will create this cell phone company and bring the cell phones in the villages and give loans to Grameen borrowers to buy herself a cell phone and sell the service of the cell phone, and she will make money. Everybody says, crazy. So these women never saw a telephone in her life. Who is she going to call?
So again, a lot of assumptions, right?
A lot of assumptions.
So who'd she call?
So I was trying to convince them, look, I'm not doing it for her to call somebody. I'm creating it so that others who need to call has to come to her, because she is the one who has the phone, and she will make money. This will be her new cow. Cash cow. So nobody believed that. Anyway, finally we got the license, and we started the work in 1997. And immediately it became a big success, because people liked this, and women started selling the service. And it became a roaring business for Grameen borrowers to have a telephone. Once you have a telephone, you are sure getting out of poverty in a year, in a couple of years. Absolutely guaranteed. Because you make so much money by renting out the telephone you got. But the telephone service expanded very rapidly because of people's eagerness to communicate and hold it. Today, Grameen Phone is the largest cell phone in the country. It has over 17 million subscribers.
They told you you'd sell about 250,000 cell phones, right? That's what all the experts...
Yes,
predicted when you started. So.
When the consultant was hired at the beginning to estimate what is the market potential, his estimate was, by 2005, this company can go up to 250,000 subscribers. But in reality, in reality, we reached 8 million at that time. So that's the kind of consultant's imagination. So that company became very successful. Today, telephone is everywhere. You can call anybody anywhere, and they can call anywhere. And also, today, Grameen Phone is the largest taxpayer in the whole country. So you can imagine how big the company is.
Fantastic. Yeah. So let's talk about social business. What is a social business? And in particular, how is it distinguished from this whole notion we all hear a lot about, which is corporate social responsibility? What's different about your idea?
The idea that I was arguing for is now in the economic theory, you have only one kind of business to make money. And this business, the core of this business, or the mission of this business, is to maximize profit. That's what the theory talks about. There is no other kind of business in the whole world. And first objection that I had, that the theoreticians who built this theory assume that all human beings are some kind of money-making machines. Otherwise, you cannot build a theory like that.
One dimension. They have one dimensional.
One dimension. You do only, you work only one way. This is making money. But the real human beings are different. Real human beings are multidimensional. There are so many things that one wants to achieve, one wants to do, one wants to enjoy. Not just making money. Making money is an important part of human life, but there are other things. You want to help other people, you want to change the environment that you live in, and you want to contribute in changing the life around you. Those things are not considered within the business framework. I'm saying that this has a very narrow interpretation of human being, which has distorted the entire economic structure in the whole world, and that's why we created a lot of problems. If we have to include the totality of human being as they are, real human being are, I'm arguing that you need at least two kinds of business. One business to make money, profit maximization. Another business is to business to do good to people and to good, do good to planet. This could be another business, and because it's in your heart, this is the way you think. This will be non-loss, non-dividend company with a social objective. The profit-maximizing company is all for serving yourself, the person who runs the business. It's all concentrated to aimed at oneself. The other one is aimed at the others. Nothing to me, but everything to the others. So this is, in that way, it's a completely the opposite. So if we can create those kind of non-loss, non-dividend companies, address all kinds of social issues, like the poverty, microcredit. Microcredit could be a good subject for social business. Microcredit is not an area where you want to make money. Get rich by lending money, like the guy who's lending money to Sophia Khatun, those 25 cents,
money lender. Right?
He wanted to do it to maximize his profit. So in the process, he didn't allow the borrower to get any benefit out of it. So that's a profit-maximizing principle there. But it could. What I'm saying, microcredit should be a social business, a business to help people get out of poverty, not to make money for myself. So that's a way a social business can be designed. It could be water company. There are many countries, many communities where safe drinking water is not available, polluted waters. In Bangladesh, is arsenic contaminated water. So we can create a water company which brings safe drinking water at a very affordable price so that everybody can drink safely and avoid diseases and health hazards and so on and so forth. This could be a social business. So this is what I'm arguing.
But this social business, it is a business.
It's a business.
It's non-loss, so let's start there, right? It needs to be self-sustaining.
Absolutely.
It needs to make money.
Absolutely.
And it needs to compete against, if it's a water company, it needs to compete against any other water company that might be a profit maximization business, correct?
Yeah.
So it's a level playing field.
It's a level playing field. You are giving more options to people. You are bringing more competition in the market. So you are fulfilling all the conditions of free market. At the same time, you are addressing the issues that remain unaddressed by the profit maximizers. There are many things profit maximizers will never do. For example, there are many vaccines available for very, very important diseases, but these are not produced because profit maximizers don't find them attractive enough in terms of making money, so they don't produce that vaccine, and people die. So there is a case where you can create a social business where you produce that vaccine so that you save the people, and you run it as a business.
You would produce it profitably. You just don't produce it as profitably as Wall Street or whatever might demand.
Profit maximizing.
Right, so that's a difference. And in terms of no dividends, so all the money you do make, instead of being paid out, although I think if you're an investor, your initial investors get their money back,
Your investors can take it back.
They take back their
only dividends you don't get,
okay.
But you still own the company. It's
but everything
company.
Else goes back into
Absolutely.
The business.
Yeah.
So you pay out your investors, and once they're even,
right.
Then everything goes back into the business.
Yes? Yeah.
Fascinating. This is, like with all your things, more than theory. You have started a joint venture with Danone, right? The yogurt company. Yeah. Can you talk about that? And this is and how it is really, I think, a great example of a social business in terms of all the levels it works on, from where you've located your factory to the supply chain and so on.
Yeah. When I was arguing about that, people didn't understand. Very difficult to kind of touch it, what it is that I'm talking about. So I was trying to demonstrate. So we created several instances of social businesses ourselves. One of them is an interesting one. It was a chance meeting with the chairman of Danone company in Paris. He invited me for lunch, brought all his top officials for the lunch, and he wanted to know more about Grameen Bank. He was very curious, so I answered all the questions. And then I asked him about what does Danone do. So he explained what Danone does globally and so on. He wanted to know about Grameen. I wanted to know about Danone. Then I said, well, why don't we create a company with the name Grameen Danone and in Bangladesh? He said, to do what? I said, you said your yogurt is very tasty. Everybody loves it. Why don't we produce yogurt? So the conversation went on, and I said, the idea is there are millions of malnourished children in Bangladesh. We can produce this yogurt and bring all the macronutrients which are missing in the malnourished children, the iodine, the vitamin, zinc, iron, whatever.
It's like fortified.
Fortified, exactly. Fortified yogurt. Put it in the yogurt, and it's fortified yogurt, and still have the same taste, the very attractive, delicious yogurt. And then we sell it to the poor children who are malnourished and make it so cheap, they will find it very attractive snack for themselves. He immediately agreed. He said, let's do that. So I said, but I'm not finished yet. I said, it will be a social business. He said, what is social business? So I explained that you invest and we invest. It will be a joint venture. And you can... Over time, you can take back your investment money, and we can take back investment money, but no dividend after that, because it will be all for the achievement of the goal that we have set, which is to bring nutrition to the children who are missing the nutrition and have a healthy children. He immediately said, okay, I agree. Then I thought he didn't understand my English. So I sent him an email elaborating everything what I said. And he wrote back right away. He said, I understood everything. We agree. Let's go and do it. And we did it. Now that company is operating and that plant has been set up. And we wanted to have a very small plant in the village. And the designer of the plant was shocked because he designed all the big plants in Brazil, in Indonesia, mega plants,
right?
Mega plants for milk plant, yogurt plant, and in India, in China, huge plants. So I said, make the smallest possible plant because we want to have it a very tiny coverage area. He couldn't understand why I'm saying that. I said, look, I want to make it very small. He was very unhappy. He spent a few days in Bangladesh. And suddenly he appeared before me. He said, Dr. Yunus, I did it. And I'm so happy. It's a cute little plant. I have fallen in love with this plant because I have used all the state-of-the-art technology into this plant. I have not even used it yet in a big plant.
Wow.
But I put it here. So this will work beautifully. And it is working beautifully.
And why did you want it small?
I wanted it small for several reasons, so that the area of coverage is small. It will be the local milk going back to the local people, local children, and so that they know the whole process. Because economy has become something so disconnected. Where the milk comes from, where the chicken comes from, you don't know. You just buy it from the grocery shop, so you don't know each other and so on. So here it will be one point. Another point is, the smaller the area of service, you avoid the cold chain, which is a very expensive thing. So you have yogurt which you can consume in 48 hours. After 48 hours, you don't have to spend a lot of money for keeping it cool and all that. So you can bring down the cost of the yogurt as simple as possible. And I was insisting that the cups that yogurt will come should be biodegradable. So they said, well, we never used it before, but let us see. So they were looking around the world where they can find it. Finally, they found it in China. It's a cornstarch. So they said, well, they brought the sample. This is the one we're going. It's very good. It's biodegradable. I said, can I eat it? I said, no, you can't eat it. I said, no, we should have something which we can eat.
Edible container.
And I gave the example of ice cream. I said, when I buy ice cream, I get in a cone, I eat the cone. And I always loved cones. So I said, why can't you do that? Because after all, poor people are paying for it. Why should they pay for something which they have to throw away? So why can't you find it? And it should carry nutrition for the children. So now they have asked their research facility in Paris. They said they will take about a year to find out an edible cups. I said, no, you get only 6 months. So they are still trying that. They have not done that. But we are using the biodegradable cups. So you have to look at all possible ways where you cut down the cost. If you are a profit maximizer, you go into frills. The more frill you add, the more profit becomes. So you don't bring simple thing. You always add something, to either a flavor or the color or a design or a container or something big for a little thing. The real thing is so small. You spend so much money on the frills of it. So people are paying for that. In case of social business, you don't have to because you are doing it to serve the people, to address whatever the social goal is. That's what you want to address.
I've got a lot more questions about the Dow Jones social average that you foresee in the future and lots of wonderful
That's
things.
Right.
But I want to open it up because I'm sure all of you have questions for Professor Yunus as well. So are there questions out there? Sure, if I can see one back there to start. So,
my question has to do with the loan sharks. I'm sure as you built this, you ran across people who were profiting from the poor, and who probably objected to your expanding the economic opportunities to them. I wonder if you could enlighten us on that.
Yeah, they objected. They didn't like it. They spread rumors. But the moneylenders, the loan sharks, were not the only one who objected to our work. So in the whole crowd, they got lost. There's so many who objected to us. Men who objected to us. Because we lend to women. So that became more aggressively. And then it took a religious shape. Religious people saying that what you are doing is against religion. It must be stopped because you are lending money to women. So that became stronger than the money lenders, stronger than anybody else. The religious voice comes in. So we have to go on arguing with the religious people, and we have to draw in the history of Islam and what the Islam was all about, how women did everything in the original period of Islam when it began, and also kind of bring to the notice, remind them, the Prophet Muhammad. He started his career working for a businesswoman. He worked as a staff employee of a businesswoman, and later he married her. So I said, if you want to be a good Muslim, you look for a businesswoman. So we had to go through all the kinds of things all around. Academicians disliked it because this is not development. Giving tiny loans, you are fooling the whole world, everybody. You are distracting things. I said, look, I'm not taking somebody's money away. This is a business. Why are you objecting to it? So all kinds of opposition came to it. Development economists, they thought this is something... has nothing to do with development at all. This is not development. Development is about building roads, building communication facilities, and so on. Giving tiny loans to buy a few chicken or buy me a few basket, that's not development. Anyway, I'm just summing up the diversity of the opposition that we have to face. One of the piece was the moneylenders. Yeah.
Great. Well, there's a lot of you. Let me, how about right here in the front? There's somebody... Yeah, in there who was. Oop.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a lot of questions, but I've been told to limit it to three. I believe the bank doesn't charge interest. Is that true? And is that
Bank charges interest.
Oh, the bank does charge interest. Is that a problem in the Islamic country, number one? Number two, has the bank expanded outside of Bangladesh? And number three, what do you mean when you say the owners of the bank are the borrowers?
Interest rate, yes, bank charges interest. And we had a lot of opposition because of this conflict with the religion and interest. But that didn't last very long because all banks in Bangladesh charges interest. Hmm. So we are not the new one who brought it in. But since we do it in the villages, most banks don't work in the village. Banks always feel comfortable in the cities. They don't go to the village. We are the only one who do the business in the village. So we came very close to the people who are very sensitive about the religious issues. So they opposed us a lot. And then we had the help from many Islamic scholars. They said, don't worry about this accusation because what you are doing is perfectly all right with Islam. So I said, can you explain how we defend ourselves? I said, very simple, because Islam is opposed to interest. It entirely banned the interest because it is an instrument of exploitation. So you don't want to keep any instrument of exploitation into your system. So they banned it. But what you are doing is not an instrument of exploitation because this bank is owned by the borrowers. So the borrower, the owners themselves cannot exploit themselves. So no matter what you call, in the eyes of Islam, this is not interest that they are talking about. So you are completely safe because it is entirely inside. It's not somebody coming from outside and exploiting you by drawing in interest. We keep explaining that way, but who wants to listen to that? So it goes on. Still people feel very unhappy that we charge interest. Many people who are great fan of Grameen Bank, absolutely, they are delighted that I do that, but they'll whisper, can you change the name interest? Call it something else. Because they feel very sensitive to that religious thing, yeah. And about the ownership, yes, the borrowers own, they buy the shares. Within Grameen Bank, I should have mentioned, not only we lend money, we also collect savings. We encourage everybody to save, even a tiny penny, whatever it is. Every week, as you pay your installment, put a little penny or whatever you can into your savings account. And that grows a lot. It became big money. Everybody have savings account and so on. When you have more than $1.50, because our share per share price is $1.50, whenever you have $1.50 in your savings account, you may authorize us to buy yourself a share. It's up to you. You are entitled to a share. You may take it, you may not take it. But it became so popular to buy one share because it gives a lot of prestige, a lot of facility, and so on. So everybody buys that share. So we have 7.5 million shareholders. They elect their board members. That's one occasion they see how important they are because they elect the board members out of themselves. And she can become a board member, and it's a very important position. You are running the biggest bank in the country, coming from the village. And our board is consisted of those borrowers who got elected into the board by the borrowers who voted for them. So there's a big contest every 3 years to elect the board. So that's how they become the owners of the bank. About the Grameen Bank working out, so yes, the idea has spread all over the world, but there are many cases where people wanted our help to do it. We have a program called Build, Operate, Transfer. You give us a contract. We go to the country where you want to set up a Grameen program. We send our staff from Bangladesh to set it up as if we are opening another branch in another village in Bangladesh. We do it and set it up and let it run, bring it to the profitable level. And then you tell us who do we hand it over to, and we hand it over and go home. Or you can let us continue with this, and we continue. We run in 7 different countries right now, those built operate companies that we have. And now many other countries are approaching us to set it up. China has become the most important and very eager country to have build, operate, transfer companies in China. Each province of China is allowed to negotiate with us separately. So each province is pursuing us to set up those institutions. So the idea has spread and is spreading more and more.
We do. The woman in the back there has been very patient. So. Yeah.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
When you first came out, Rick said you were doing God's work. I want to know where you get the idea. Is it a spiritual one? Because you talk about feeding, I mean, not feeding the person, but giving him the tools to feed himself, where he can feed himself for life. And social business sounds like a terrible thing in the United States. So I want to know if you see it working in the United States, where socialism and capitalism and all these isms don't work. Thank you.
This one will work. This is just the beginning. We are talking about it, and I'm sure somebody will start a social business here. There's so many scope here. Like, for example, in my book, I mentioned about Warren Buffett, who donated some $36 billion to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I'm saying, before he decided to give this money to Bill Gates Foundation, I wish I had a chance to talk to him. I'll talk him out of it and say, why don't you keep at least some money and start a social business? And this social business will be to address all the 47 million Americans who don't have health insurance. Because you are an insurance man, you know ins and outs of insurance. So while you are doing a good job, why don't you design an insurance program with your money, start it, and then be remembered in history that you have done something nobody else could do, not even a government could do, but you did it. So this is the kind of opportunity available. And this could be a beautiful social business to provide health insurance to 47 million Americans.
You raise an important point that you're not talking about with the creation of social business. There is still a role for philanthropy, yes? I mean, it's not an either or.
No, I'm not taking away anything. I'm just adding one more piece.
Okay.
If you are interested, you can take advantage of it. It could come from the business side. Business people can create social business. It could come from philanthropy side. Foundations can create social business. I'm encouraging the foundations to create social business fund within the foundation so that they can support wherever social business comes up. Here is the money available and come as an investor. Because I'm a social business investor. I'm an owner of this company. You do it. We support you with the money. And we feel happy. We don't want to make money out of it. We want to solve the problem that we see and we agree with it. Yeah.
Yes.
Dhanyabad, Dr. Yunus. We're from Results, Sam's Group. would you talk about the Beggars program? It's so impressive.
No, this is a program that we started four years back because there are a lot of controversy on one issue, saying that microcredit is a fine idea, it's a great idea, but it works only for the entrepreneurial poor. And this is one idea that this one statement I can never stand, because to me, all human beings are entrepreneurs. So there is no entrepreneurial poor and non-entrepreneurial poor. All poor, all human beings, rich, poor, or anybody, are entrepreneurs because it is part of human being. Human being, you cannot take it out. Entrepreneurship cannot take it out because that's how we came to this planet. That's why we survived on this planet, our entrepreneurial ability.
Creativity.
Creativity. Then we take initiative to solve our problems. So we wanted to demonstrate it. One way we thought we can demonstrate it by lending exclusively to the beggars. So we started a separate program, Lend to the Beggars. So we sit down with the beggars, talk to them, and find out at what point he or she became a beggar. Because what was the tipping point? Because after all, he was a normal human being living her life, living his life. At one point, she was pushed and pushed, and she became a beggar and stretched her hand for survival, for taking care of her kids or whatever. once we go through all this stuff, and we say, as you go from house to house begging, would you care to carry some merchandise with you and sell? And it appeals to them because we made it very clear, we are not asking for anything extra. You do it anyway. You go to houses to beg. All you do, carry a little basket, carry a little bag or whatever you have. See, candy, sweets, or some toys for the kids, whatever people will like. And people will have options. They will not just shoo you away. Sorry, I can't give you anything today. Say, oh, I have something to sell. Would you be interested to look at it? Then give them option. Maybe they would like something, or the kids will love to have something to buy. And the beggars started liking that. And initially, we thought we'll have a couple of thousand beggars in the program, and we'll see what happens to those beggars. Can they really run the business? People say, we're saying, well, you know, you need to train the beggars. They don't know what a business is. I said, look, I'm not the training guy. I'm not interested in training. So let's see what happens. It became very popular. Popular not only among the beggars, it was popular among the beggars, but it became very popular among our staff. We have 27,000 staff. Everybody wanted to serve beggars. So I said, only one beggar per person. No more. Because at that time, I have no idea how this is going to work out. So I didn't want to mess up the whole thing because everybody wanted to go for the beggars. But there's a tremendous pressure coming in to me. They want to have 10 beggars per person. 10. I said, no, 10 is too many. Just take one care. And I started yielding to it, 2, 3, 4. Now we came up to 4, allowed 4. So we have more than 100,000 beggars in our program. And in last 4 years, what is amazing, more than 10,000 beggars now have stopped begging completely. They just became door-to-door salesperson. And some of them became very successful personal shoppers. Because women in Bangladesh can't go to the market. So they ask their husbands to bring this, bring that. And husbands are husbands. They always forget. They can't remember. Oh, I say, oh, okay, tomorrow, I'll bring it tomorrow. And tomorrow he forgets again. So now it became very convenient. You just tell the personal shopper, bring me this, and you pay her, and she brings it for you. Very easy. So the remaining 90,000, I would say they're just about part-time beggars because they're mixing, begging, and selling at the same time. My colleagues are getting very impatient. So why can't they join like the other 10,000 have done? Stop begging and concentrate on the selling. I said, look, they are trying to close down their begging division. They are in the process of restructuring their business. They need to strengthen the sales division. So give them time. After all, they are in this begging business for a lifetime. So it takes time to close down one division and start another one. So we are waiting to see how it goes. Amazing thing. The loan they ask for, typical loan would be something like $12, $15. With $10, $15, if you can change the life of a beggar into a dignified salesperson, that now you're not afraid, you are selling something. I ask when I meet the beggars, I said, how does it go? How does it feel to you now you're doing that? One common answer I get, they get very excited, not about the money they make. They say, now when we go and knock the door, when they find out who I am, immediately open the door and let come in. When I was a beggar, nobody will open the door. They will just give whatever they have to get through the window and we go. But now they open the door and then give a stool to sit. Nobody offered us a stool to sit. So that changes completely. That's what impresses her very much, that I'm a respected person. I'm not. And the kids come around, what did you bring today? They want to see what they can buy because there's a person coming with the items that they like. So this is what the beggars think. And I also remind with this that if Grameen Bank gave $15 to all these 100,000 beggars as a grant, as a charity, Grameen Bank could do that. Grameen Bank deals with hundreds of thousands, billions of dollars. It could give $15 to all this. It doesn't cost anything to Grameen Bank. What would happen? Would they have changed anything? Nothing. They will probably enjoy their food a little bit, buy a little essentials with that $15. And for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, they come back and say, can we get some more? They will still remain beggars. But we designed it as a loan. We said, this is an interest-free loan. You don't have to worry. This money will never grow. So it will $10 will always remain $10. And there is no time limit. So you don't have to worry that I have to pay it back in 1 month, 1 year, 10 year, whatever. There is no time limit. It's up to you. The condition is if you pay it back, you can take another loan, bigger loan, whatever you want. The door is open. They are paying back. All the money that we lent out so far in 4 years, more than 60% of that money has already been paid back. So this is really something to see how people can take things seriously and challenge themselves into doing things.
You know, I'm afraid we're going to have to...
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.